No sooner have you turned off the freeway onto San Tomas Avenue than you are back in the tacky, sleepy, slow-poke Los Angeles of the 30s, still convalescent from the Depression, with no money to spare for fresh coats of paint. And how charming it is. An up-and-down terrain of steep little hills with white houses of cracked stucco perched insecurely on their sides and tops. It is made to look quaint rather than ugly by the hopelessly intertwisted cat's cradle of wires and telephone poles. The San Tomas State College campus is back on the other side of the freeway. You cross over to it by a bridge, back into the nowadays of destruction, reconstruction, destruction. Here the little hills have been trucked away bodily, or had their tops sliced off by bulldozers, and the landscape is gashed with raw terraces, tract upon tract of low-roofed dormitory dwellings, invariably called homes, and described as a new concept in living, are being opened up as fast as they can be connected with the sewers and the power lines. It's a slander to say that they are identical. Some have brown roofs and some green. And the tiles in their bathrooms come in several different colors. The tracts have their individuality, too. Each one has a different name, of the kind that realtors can always be relied on to invent. Sky Acres, Vista Grande, Grosvenor Heights. The storm center of all this grading, shoveling, hauling, and hammering is the college campus itself. A clean, modern factory, brick and glass and big windows, already three-quarters built, is being finished in a hysterical hurry. The construction noises are such that in some classrooms the professors can hardly be heard. When the factory is fully operational, it will be able to process 20,000 graduates. But in less than 10 years, it will have to cope with 40,000 or 50,000. So then, everything will be torn down again and built up twice as tall. However, it is arguable that by that time, the campus will be cut off from the outside world by its own parking lots, which will then form an impenetrable forest of cars, abandoned in despair by the students during the week-long traffic jams of the near future. Today, George is lucky. There's room for him on the lot nearest his classroom. George has been trying to train himself lately to recognize his students' cars. He's continually starting these self-improvement projects. Sometimes it's memory training, sometimes a new diet, sometimes just a vow to read some unreadable 100th best book. He seldom perseveres in any of them for long. Today he is pleased to be able to spot 3 cars. There's the beat-up, not-so-white Ford coupe belonging to Tom Kugelman, on the back of which he has printed Slow White. There's the Chinese Hawaiian boy's grime-gray Pontiac, with one of those joke stickers in the rear window. The only ism I believe in is abstract expressionism. The joke isn't a joke in his particular case, because he really is an abstract painter. Or is this some super subtlety? At all events, it seems incongruous that anyone with such a sweet Cheshire cat smile and cream-smooth skin and cat-clean neatness could produce such gloomy, muddy canvases or own such a filthy car. He has the beautiful name of Alexander Mong. And there's the well-waxed, spotless, scarlet MG driven by Buddy Sorensen, the wild, watery-eyed albino who is a basketball star and wears a ban the bomb button. George has caught glimpses of Buddy streaking past on the freeway, laughing to himself, as if the absurd little sitz bath of a thing had run away with him. And he didn't care. So now, George has arrived. He's not nervous in the least. As he gets out of his car, he feels an upsurge of energy, of eagerness, for the play to begin, and he walks eagerly, with a springy step, along the gravel path, past the music building toward the department office. He is all actor now, an actor on his way up from the dressing room, hastening through the backstage world of props and lamps and stagehands to make his entrance. A veteran, calm and assured, he pauses for a well-measured moment in the doorway of the office, and then boldly, clearly, with a subtly modulated British intonation which his public demands of him, speaks his opening line, "Good morning." And the three secretaries, each one of them a charming and accomplished actress in her own chosen style, recognize him instantly without even a flicker of doubt and reply, "Good morning," to him. There's something religious here, like responses in church, a reaffirmation of faith in the basic American dogma that it is always a good morning. Good despite the Russians and their rockets and all the ills and worries of the flesh. For of course we know, don't we, that the Russians and the worries are not really real. They can be unthought and made to vanish, and therefore the morning can be made to be good. Very well then, it is good. Every teacher in the English department has his or her pigeonhole in this office, and all of them are stuffed with papers. What a mania for communication! A notice of the least important committee meeting on the most trivial of subjects will be run off and distributed in hundreds of copies. Everybody is informed of everything. George glances through them all and then tosses the lot into the wastebasket with one exception, an oblong card slotted and slitted and ciphered by an IBM machine, expressing some poor bastard of a student's academic identity. Indeed, this card is his identity. Suppose, instead of signing it as requested and returning it to the personnel office, George were to tear it up. Instantly, that student would cease to exist, as far as San Tomas State was concerned. He would become academically invisible, and only reappear with the very greatest difficulty after performing the most elaborate propitiation ceremonies. Countless offerings of forms filled out in triplicate and notarized affidavits to the gods of the IBM. George signs the card, holding it steady with two fingertips. He dislikes even to touch these things, for they are the runes of an idiotic, but nevertheless potent and evil magic, the magic of the think machine gods, which has one dogma: we cannot make a mistake. Their magic consists in this, that whenever they do make a mistake, which is quite often, it is perpetuated and thereby becomes a non-mistake. Carrying the card by its extreme corner, George brings it over to one of the secretaries, who will see that it gets back to personnel. The secretary has a nail file on her desk. George picks it up, saying, "Let's see if that old robot'll know the difference," and pretends to be about to punch another slit in the card. The girl laughs, but only after a split-second look of sheer terror, and the laugh itself is forced. George has uttered blasphemy. Feeling rather pleased with himself, he leaves the department building, headed for the cafeteria. And now, all around George, approaching him, crossing his path from every direction, is the male and female raw material which is fed daily into this factory along the conveyor belts of the freeways to be processed, packaged, and placed on the market. Hurrying in pursuit of their schedules, loitering in flirty talk, strolling in earnest argument, muttering some lesson to themselves alone, all book-burdened, all harassed. What do they think they're up to here? Well, there is the official answer: preparing themselves for life, which means a job and security in which to raise children. To prepare themselves for life, which means a job and security in which... But despite all the vocational advisers, the pamphlets pointing out to them what good money you can earn if you invest in some solid technical training, pharmacology, let's say, or accountancy, or the varied opportunities offered by the vast field of electronics. There are still, incredibly enough, quite a few of them who persist in writing poems, novels, plays. Goofy from lack of sleep, they scribble in snatched moments between classes, part-time employment, and their married lives. Their brains are dizzy with words as they mop out an operating room, sort mail at a post office, fix baby's bottle, fry hamburgers. And somewhere, in the midst of their servitude to the must-be, the mad might-be whispers to them to live, know, experience. What? Marvels. The season in hell, the journey to the end of the night, the seven pillars of wisdom, the clear light of the void. Will any of them make it? Oh, sure. One at least. Two or three at most, in all these searching thousands. Here in their midst, George feels a sort of vertigo. Oh, God, what will become of them all? What chance have they? Ought I to yell out to them right here and now that it's hopeless? But George knows he can't do that, because absurdly, inadequately, in spite of himself almost, he is a representative of the hope. And the hope is not false. No, it's just that George is like a man trying to sell a real diamond for a nickel on the street. The diamond is protected from all but the tiniest few, because the great hurrying majority can never stop to dare to believe that it could conceivably be real.